Today's macroeconomic news brought to you by the letters A, D, and P. 3 days of grim, grim jobs reports started today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday today, the 6th day of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You know, there are days when the economic calendar is your friend, when the news is good and promising and good times lie ahead. And then there is today and tomorrow and Friday, a trifecta, if you will. We learned this morning, as you have surely heard, the private payroll processing company ADP reported 20 million people lost their jobs in April. Tomorrow is going to bring us another report on first-time unemployment claims in the millions, maybe 3 million. And then on Friday, the official and much more detailed government report on April unemployment. And those three data points are going to come to define this economy and the people in it for some time to come. And don't just take my word for it. Melanie Long is an assistant professor of economics at the College of Worcester.
Well, the first thing that comes to my mind is the significant variety of situations that these workers who are now jobless are going to find themselves in. There are some households that have set aside rainy day funds that they can draw on, and then there are other households who don't have those savings to fall back on, and we know that that's a pretty significant portion of American households.
So with that as prologue to Texas, we go now where businesses are starting to get back in business, which means people can get back to work. Not, though, as Marketplace's Andy Euler reports from Austin, without some mixed feelings.
Michelle, who lives in Dallas, was furloughed in March from her job as a volunteer coordinator at a nonprofit. We're not using her last name here because she fears reprisal from her employer for speaking out. She was asked to come back to work on April 27th, but she's still at home. She has a 2-year-old, and under the CARES Act, that relief package passed in late March, she's able to take more time off at 2/3 of her salary. She asked for 3 weeks.
But I don't really know what's going to happen at the end of those 3 weeks, if those will be extended. I mean, I know some states are opening things back up, but I don't really like the idea of being a guinea pig.
She says she fears getting sick when she does go back. Michelle figured out a way to extend her benefits, even though she was called back to work. Of course, not everybody has that option.
When you become unemployed, historically, you've had to identify that you are actively seeking employment.
That's Tom Smith. He teaches finance at Emory University.
So if you have work available, you're not really considered unemployed, right? You're making a choice. You typically would be denied unemployment insurance if you have an opportunity to go back to work and you choose not to.
Eventually, unemployment's going to run out and people need to work. But Michelle Evermore with the National Employment Law Project says that's going to put a lot of people in a tough spot.
One could make the argument that going back to work in a COVID environment is no longer suitable, that the working conditions aren't similar to what they were when they worked at the job before.
As for Michelle in Dallas, she's unclear about her work future.
You know, I don't have any volunteers to manage, so I don't really know what things are going to look like when I do go back eventually.
She says even though she was called back last week, she's worried she's eventually going to be laid off. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Staying with jobs here for a second, the latest Marketplace Edison Research poll is out this week. I think I mentioned that yesterday. And among the data points and the crosstabs and the grim drip drip of news about layoffs and furloughs and pay cuts was this item. Among those who are still employed, more than a third of people have had their hours cut, which follows, I guess, given the way things have been going. But 16% of people who are still working are working more hours. From the Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
I reached electrician Mike Cargill while he was out on a job in Houston, Texas.
Right now, we are swapping an electrical panel inside somebody's house that was beginning to overheat.
Home electricity usage has surged during the lockdown, and so has his pay.
Because people are at home, you know, watching TV or plugging their laptop in different areas to work from home and realizing, oh my goodness, this plug doesn't work.
Meanwhile, his fiance, who works in marketing, and his dad, who consults in the oil fields, are out of work. Every recession has winners and losers, says Julia Pollack, a labor economist with job site ZipRecruiter. But the juxtapositions caused by this economic shock have been extreme.
job postings have fallen 47%. At the same time, it has caused sales and user growth to soar in some other businesses.
Like grocery stores, e-commerce, and pharmaceuticals. And though big companies like Amazon and Walmart are hiring to meet increased demand, she says more businesses are just increasing hours for existing staff. But not all of them are getting paid more, says Jed Kolko, chief economist with job site Indeed.
It's one thing to want more hours, get more hours, and get paid for it. It's something else entirely to have to work more hours just to get your same job done for the same pay.
Like Carolyn Behrens, a middle school English teacher in Richmond, Virginia, who has revamped her curriculum for remote classes and switched to more one-on-one sessions with students with learning disabilities.
So I end up doing a lot more individually. It takes longer. It just takes longer.
She estimates she's working about 2 extra hours a day, but as an already overworked teacher, she stopped keeping track. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Mixed on Wall Street today. Not much enthusiasm up or down. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We're learning a lot about the mostly hidden inner workings of this economy as this crisis works its will on us. Today's example, the supply chain, specifically for us right now, the food supply chain. There was the initial stockpiling thing. There's a looming meat shortage, if reports are to be believed, and dairy farmers are dumping millions of gallons of milk because they can't get it to market. So we got Beth Ford on the phone. She is the CEO of Land O'Lakes. Yes, butter, but really the whole dairy industry is in her portfolio. Ms. Ford, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I'm sure this is not the first time you've been asked this question or asked to clarify, but there will be listeners to this program who think of Land O'Lakes and they think butter. But you are so much more than that. Give us the 30 seconds, would you?
30 seconds. We're a Fortune 200 ag and food business, but we're also a 100-year-old cooperative. And we literally start right back to the farm. We are owned by farmers. We start with Winfield Technologies, our seed crop protection business. We have our Purina business, and then we have our dairy business, started in 1921 mm-hmm. by Upper Midwest dairy farmers trying to get power in the channel, get their sweet cream butter into the population centers in the east, and they formed a supply cooperative, which are those other elements, the seed crop protection and the animal nutrition business.
Man, there's a lot in there. You've done that 30-second spiel before. Let me unpack it a little bit, and I want to talk about you in the heart of agriculture and the supply chain, because as you surely know, we have hog farmers in big trouble, and we have reports of dairy farmers having to pour milk down the drain. What is your level of concern about your constituents in the cooperative and in your supply chain?
This is a very challenging time for agriculture. I start always by saying, you know, one of our pillars of our national security is our safe, affordable food supply, and that remains the case. What you see is a distortion and disruption caused by COVID. Most significantly, if you think of the dairy side, restaurants aren't open, schools aren't open, et cetera. And so where does that milk go? Well, you don't just turn the cow off, right? So it's not that we don't have enough food in the country. We do. It's not that we don't have production. We do. It is that there's a disruption in the value chain or the supply chain, because what we've seen is a significant drop in prices at the farm level.
Right.
So that means the price that the farmers are paid is much lower.
Are you satisfied, back to sort of your corporate job, as it were, are you satisfied with the level of support and assistance that the federal government is giving your sector, agriculture and dairy in particular?
I'm concerned. I mean, I think that it's a prioritization issue. This is why I say this is a priority for our national security. I'm not sure that we have enough support at this point. We probably don't. We're going to have to go back again. You can see it right now with these shutdowns within the value chain.
Mm-hmm.
And this isn't about mm-hmm. a handout. This is about trying to make sure that we are stabilizing the operating environment for our farmers, our growers, our producers, so that they can get to the other side.
Let's talk about the other side for a second, and then I'll get out of your hair. If we have another, look, I'm making this number up, but if we have another 4 months of supply chain disruptions, maybe 6 months, and dairy farmers having to dispose of their products before they get to market, Are your co-op members going to be able to survive?
Will all of them? Likely not. Will many of them? Yes. We continue to invest in innovation and in partnership with our members to try to make sure that the money that we make on the goods that we sell goes back into their pockets in the form of patronage or dividends and allows them to strengthen their operation.
Does the piecemeal nature of things starting back up again concern you? I mean, one of the great strengths of the American economy has been a solid and consistent supply chain, and now it's going to be disrupted in fragments depending on literally where you are. Does that worry you?
It does. I mean, I also sit on the Business Roundtable Board, and many organizations have recommended to the administration some level of standardization about what the policies are. So this kind of rolling opening, I certainly understand that. That's actually less the concern. It's more about the consistency of policies so that businesses can react to that. Some level of standardization will be important for an efficient value chain going forward.
Beth Ford, she is the CEO of Land O'Lakes. Ms. Ford, thanks for your time. I really appreciate it.
You bet. Thank you.
The New York City subway system is one of the world's great economic forces. Yes, it's deeply troubled, crumbling infrastructure, management tugs of war, political opportunism at every turn. But think about what it does and what it means for the center of global capitalism. It literally gets people where they need to be so they can make the gears of this economy go. And that is why it was notable last night that for the first time ever, the New York subway did a planned closure. From last night until further notice, it's going to shut down every night, 1 to 5 a.m. for trains and stations to be disinfected. And you know who that's going to matter to with most of us working from home right now? The essential workers making the gears of this economy go right now. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab has the story.
Grocery stores don't stock themselves. Overnight, workers unload trucks and restock shelves. Bobby Daubert is one of those workers. He lives in Brooklyn and works at a market 8 miles from his house. He usually takes the subway a half hour, but not today.
One bus, 26 stops.
And then a half-mile walk. It took an hour, and the bus was completely full with no room for social distancing. But it's the only way he can get to work. He checked Uber this morning, just in case, and it was $35. With hazard pay, he makes $18 an hour.
I mean, if it wasn't for public transportation, I wouldn't have a job right now.
The Transit Authority says 11,000 people have been riding the trains in the early morning hours during stay-at-home orders. During the subway shutdown, it's giving essential workers who can't access buses a free nightly car ride. But for now, Daubert and people like him will have to find other ways to get to their jobs.
By and large, those are essential workers with especially long and difficult commutes.
Danny Perlstein is with the Riders Alliance. He says the majority of people who ride the subway late are super commuters, workers who travel 90 minutes or more. And that's during normal times.
New Yorkers have organized our lives around the fact that you can get anywhere in the city at any time of day or night by public transit.
The city's massive economy depends on the subway. And Sarah Kaufman at NYU's Rudin Center for Transportation says so does the city's identity.
Right now, having a subway that doesn't run 24/7 brings that into question.
She says this could make people question whether New York needs a 24-hour subway, even in a post-pandemic world. And without those late-night rides, some of the industries that anchor New York, like nightlife, would change too. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Coming up.
So we're going to use our small trucks and get on the road and head up to Dallas and make Mother's Day deliveries to the stores there.
Flowers in this coronavirus economy. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 218 points today. That is 0.9%, 23,664. The NASDAQ up 45 points, about a half percent, 88.54 there. The S&P 500 down 20 points, nearly 7%, 0.7%, rather. Whew, that'd have been something, 28 and 48. Disney reported second quarter earnings late Tuesday. Bad. Theme parks, good. Disney Plus, Disney dropped a 10% today. That other streaming business, Netflix, clicked up about 2.25% today. Beyond Meat, the plant-based food company, reported late Tuesday sales more than doubled in its first quarter. Beyond Meat shares sizzled up 26% today. Bond price, come on, sizzled up. Bonds fell, yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 0.70%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. One of the things that happens when something happens as fast as this crisis has happened is that decisions get forced. Time, as the great disruptor, is, I guess, a way to think about that. And a lot of the people being disrupted right now are small business owners who are being forced to make tough choices that were unthinkable just a couple of months ago. From our podcast, This is Uncomfortable, Marketplace's Rima Kreis has the story of one such entrepreneur.
Drew Dalzell works in the entertainment industry, doing sound design for theme parks and haunted houses. So pretty early on, he found himself out of work.
There was one day that it just all snowballed, and it's just cancellation after cancellation after cancellation after cancellation. And we lost almost all of our bookings in one 48-hour period.
Drew runs a small company based in Los Angeles called Diablo Sound, which he founded back in 2006. He tried cobbling together small gigs, just anything, to keep his company afloat, but nothing worked. So in March, he decided to furlough his small team of 7 employees.
It was watching 20 years of building this career just evaporate around me, you know, and that's devastating.
His company had already been in debt. Drew himself hadn't taken a paycheck since December just to keep his employees paid. He says the decision to lay off his team felt miserable.
Intellectually, I know that this is way beyond my control, but it's hard to not feel like I failed.
Why do you say that?
I'm the one that decided to do this crazy thing and run a business, and a whole bunch of people signed on to come along with me. My job is to keep that going. They all did great work, and yet we don't get to keep going, and so I feel like I didn't do my piece of the job.
Drew says they've been living off of his wife's salary as a school teacher and aren't sure how they're going to pay their mortgage. He applied for the Paycheck Protection Program loan, also known as PPP, and a much larger economic injury disaster loan. He also managed to raise almost $10,000 for his employees through GoFundMe. He says if things don't get better, Diablo Sound might file for bankruptcy, which means those worker furloughs become permanent.
If you can't gather in groups, there's no work. I mean, it's going to be the same situation as a coal miner when the mine shuts down.
So I actually had that conversation with Drew back in late March. But since then...
Hi, everyone.
Hello.
Hello. It's so good to see you all.
How y'all doing?
Drew has been able to rehire his team.
They're back from furlough.
Amazing.
So, yes, it's a qualified amazing.
His company received just under $100,000 from the Paycheck Protection Program.
I'm one of the very, very lucky small businesses. I'm thrilled I got it.
But it means his company's only got enough money to cover the next 2 months, which isn't exactly enough time for the entertainment industry to bounce back.
So we're trying to come up with plans for like, okay, how are people entertaining themselves right now? Is that anything we can help with?
Drew is ready to pivot, to reinvent the company.
All of us have been spending so much time on things like Zoom.
So he's thinking maybe we can do something there.
Can we do the equivalent of a HelloFresh box that is how to set up to do a podcast or do Zoom, where you have everything that you need in one box and full instructions and a video for how to hook it up and put it together?
Really, he says he has no idea if his business will survive, but...
You just try to solve today's problem and try to look as far forward as you can and make sure you're ready to react.
And Drew says he hopes he's reacting in the right ways. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
You can catch This Is Uncomfortable on Apple or Spotify or wherever you choose to listen. Also, by the way, should you miss it on the air, this show podcasts, as do David Brancaccio on The Morning Report and Marketplace Tech. Molly Wood in charge there. You know how when you go to the grocery store, sometimes you stop and you pick up a bouquet of flowers? Or, you know, you used to. Now it's all about grabbing the essentials and getting in and out as quickly as you can. And that right there is a problem for a whole industry of flower farmers. The cut flower industry, as it's known, much of it based here in California, is in serious trouble. Peak season is Valentine's Day to Mother's Day, Sunday, in case you lost track, by the way. So time is running out for those flower growers. And as Marketplace's Nova Sappho reports, they are not just sitting around waiting for business to pick up, you know.
Cut flower farming is an asterisk in America's $130 billion farming economy. It accounts for just over $1 billion in sales, much of it from imported flowers. The American-grown portion has been shrinking for decades. And then the coronavirus hit.
March, the government said, okay, everybody stays home. We basically lost 95% of all our market.
Rene Van Wingerden has a flower farm in Carpinteria, California, a small town along the Pacific coast north of Los Angeles. He harvests 100,000 stems a day. Normally a quarter would go to wholesalers, the rest to supermarkets. With cancellations mounting, Van Wingerden says he's been dipping into his retirement savings to keep 170 employees paid.
In our bouquet operation, we did let go of 50 people there. And I had some tears coming out of my eyes.
California farms account for about three-fourths of the nation's cut flower industry. They're generally large, supplying major grocery chains and wholesalers who then sell to smaller businesses like flower shops. Right now, they're in the same boat as Van Wingerden. Orders have dried up. And even for those farms that do have some orders, big truck lines are too busy delivering essentials, leaving flowers behind to be plowed under. Ironically, relatively smaller farms, often outside of California, are faring better. They're less reliant on wholesalers and traditional supply chains. So farmers are holding weekly online meetings and exchanging ideas on how to survive. Rita Jo Schultz attends the meetings from her farm in Alaska.
And when one person says, well, I was very successful with this trucking company, or I was very successful with opening my farm. I just put the bouquets out on a table and they come to my farm. So sharing what other people are doing, we're able to replicate that.
Schultz already direct ships her peonies from her farm via FedEx to high-end customers in other parts of the country. That's her business model, which keeps 17 people, including her, employed. During the shutdown, she's expanding into an e-commerce website to further develop one-on-one relationships with customers.
And that'll be for smaller orders. We used to do a lot of smaller orders, and we got away from that. We were happy to get away from that. Now we're going to be happy to get back to that.
Another farmer avoiding the fate of large California growers is Frank Arnosky. He's in Blanco, Texas, located between San Antonio and Austin. He owns a 20-acre farm.
We raise flowers year-round, and we ship to 40 or 50 grocery stores in the central Texas area.
Arnosky has just 10 employees. More importantly, he has his own delivery trucks.
So we're going to use our small trucks and get on the road and head up to Dallas and make Mother's Day deliveries to the stores there. But we're lucky because we have a local delivery system that we can do ourselves, so we don't have to count on truck lines.
Back in California, Rene Van Wingerden also is working to adopt some new ideas from other farms, large and small.
We're going to go direct to the florist and to the event planners, and we're going to go direct to the consumers also.
With a new subscription plan. After 5 decades farming flowers, Van Wingerden says the pandemic has shown that he needs fresh ideas to keep his business in bloom. I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, saw it yesterday, actually just forgot. As one of my favorite measurements of the impact of this crisis, that'd be the number of airline passengers the TSA is screening every day. As that starts to tick up, as high as 170,000 this week, double its lows, there is this item from Frontier Airlines for those of you who are still flying. For as low as $39, Frontier will let you maintain social distancing on your next flight. It's called the more room option. It guarantees you a seat next to an empty middle. Soft drink and carry-on fees, well, they still apply. All right, we're going, but here is a moment of economic context to leave you with. One of the key drivers of economic growth is worker productivity. Wages produced per hour worked is the simple formula. We get the first quarter report tomorrow, which includes the first 3 weeks of quarantine. So as we wait for that number, ask yourself this. How productive were you feeling as this whole thing started? All right, our media production team includes Robin Edgar, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Jay Siebold, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday. Once again, they're the ones going to the studio so that the rest of us don't have to. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.